We copy you down, Eagle.
Persistent, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Welcome to The Aggressive Life. The last voice you just heard in that clip from one of the most important moments in human history belongs to General Charlie Duke. General Duke was the Capcom for Apollo 11, the voice of mission control for the first moon landing. And while guys like Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, Duke was the voice on the ground helping make that first mission a success. But he wasn't content to stay there. In April 1972, he blasted off as part of Apollo 16, a lunar module specialist. Duke became the 10th person and the youngest ever to walk on the surface of the moon. Oh my gosh! We're going to talk to this guy today.
Yes, I can't wait.
Wow. My goodness. He spent just under 3 days on the moon conducting three excursions into the lunar surface that included activating scientific equipment, collecting rock and soil samples, and driving the lunar roving machine or moon buggy. Have you ever seen that Brian Regan comedic routine about I wish I was on the moon?
I haven't seen that, no.
Okay, I'm gonna ask our guest about that in just a minute. So anyway, before he left the moon, Charlie left something behind, a framed photograph of his family. The back of the photograph was signed and thumbprinted by his family and bore the message, quote, "This is the family of astronaut Duke from planet Earth, who landed on the moon on the 12th of April, 1972. General Duke is retired from NASA as of 1976. He spent over 265 hours in space. He retired from the U.S. Air Force as a Brigadier General. Man, I could go on and on, but I just really want to talk to this aggressive man who is an expert in something I've been geeking out on recently a lot, which is the whole space exploration, Apollo 8, Apollo 11, Apollo everything. And so we're going to spend the first portion of the interview geeking out on NASA and space and all that stuff. You may not be interested in that, but it's all a foundation for something I know you're going to be interested in, because that's why you have tuned into The Aggressive Life. So hang in there. Welcome to The Aggressive Life, General Charlie Duke.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Happy to be with you. Look forward to our time together on this podcast.
Man, I got to think that you get 20 podcast requests a day. Is that true?
Well, not that many, but a lot. And I'm a 15-year-old high school student and I'm starting this podcast and I don't do those. I pray about everyone that I accept, and because I do get a lot. I can't do them all. And Lord said, do this one. So here we are.
Well, I didn't know anything about your faith journey. I just want to talk the moon, but I'm a man of faith too. You start talking about praying about things and talking about the Lord instead of the man up above. I gather you're a follower of Jesus.
I am. As of 1976, I've been in church all my life, but Jesus was in my head, but not in my heart. And in 76, I made a decision after going through a weekend Bible study that this is really the truth. Yes. And for the very first time in my life, I experienced the peace of God. I knew I was on a different road. And sure enough, we've been that way. My family, my wife and I especially, have Duke Ministry for Christ. And we travel all over the world sharing our story. And it's been a blessing.
I wonder, when you were exposed to the gospel, having been to the moon, as I did my quick math, having been to the moon, you know, just a handful of years earlier, did your experience with space and NASA uniquely set you up to understand your Creator, or was that a separate path altogether?
No, I think it helped. I think it's in Isaiah, it says, when he made the earth, he suspended it upon nothing. And that's exactly what it looks like. There it is, suspended in the blackness of space. And he said, another verse says, God sits enthroned above the circle of the earth. Well, if you look at the pictures I got, you cannot believe that it is a flat earth. It is a circle, it is a sphere, and there it is, suspended in the blackness of space. And there are many other short scriptures like that that substantiate the creation, the reality of God. And so it's been a great blessing to me to be able to share my experiences as I walk with the Lord.
Well, maybe it's just a round flat earth like a pancake. You ever thought of that? Think about that?
No, you can look at the pictures. You can look at the pictures. It's got three dimensions to it. It's a ball up there.
Right.
And every other heavenly body is also a sphere. That's the gravity that brings it into a sphere.
As I've been geeking out on the space program, it started for me when I saw a movie on a plane, and I just was deeply moved, and I started going down the rabbit hole and just geeking out over it. I've been very, very inspired by it. And one of the things I ran across, which you probably know the inside story on this, I didn't know until recently that Buzz Aldrin actually punched a flat earther, right? The guy was saying on his podcast, come on, just admit it. You're lying. The earth is flat. And he punched him. Do you know anything more about that story?
Well, it was a little bit more than a flat earth. The guy had, in fact, called me in the middle of the night, and he didn't believe that anybody walked on the moon. So he impersonated a network reporter, and he stuck this Bible in front of Buzz and said, swear on this Bible that you walked on the moon. And a couple other pushy remarks, and Buzz finally just smashed him. And he was he put out a lot of stuff about man didn't really walk on the moon, and it's just crazy. But the evidence is overwhelming that we landed on the moon.
I'm wondering, when you were on the moon, was it different than you expected? Or at that point, did you hear from enough people that this is what your experience was when Buzz or Neil Armstrong went on, or other people? So was there a new, like, ooh, surprise, I didn't expect this, when you actually took your steps on the moon?
Well, it was not unexpected as far as the terrain goes, and the beauty and the mountains and the craters, all of that was sort of the same as others. But we landed 8,000 feet above where Buzz and Neil landed. So the rocks were different, called Wow. The mountains of the moon, or the highland, lunar highlands. And we had expected from briefings by the geologists that we'd find two volcanic flows that met across this valley where we landed, called the Kaley Plains. Well, it wasn't volcanic at all, and they got very, very excited because this was the only mission to the lunar highlands, and the rocks we picked up were breccias and igneous rocks, but no volcanics. Had volcanic inclusions in some of them, but they were totally different. So we made a big impact with the 200 pounds of moon rocks that we brought back.
8,000 feet. I didn't realize there was an 8,000 elevation foot difference on the moon. Is that the highest part of the moon, 8,000 feet?
No, it's a lot. There's other places a lot higher than that. And I don't know the maximum height on the moon. I think it's on the backside. The lowlands where the Neil landed, the dark areas of the moon, those areas were made when a big meteor hit the moon and blasted a lot of stuff out. And then back then, there was a lot of volcanic activity on the moon, and all that poured out and filled these craters actually with lava. Hmm. Every other flight landed either on a Damari or on the edges. So their rocks were similar. Ours were not. They were totally different. So they were very glad once they understood that we were speaking the truth about the rocks we were picking up. They got very, very excited. And it was the only mission to the to Mountains of the Moon. And so it was a suite of rocks, you know, just like the Earth. There's certain rocks up in Minnesota. There's certain rocks down in Texas, and the Big Bend, the Rio Grande. And so the moon's the same way. They have a lot of volcanics, but also a lot of the highlands material. All the light area on the moon is the mountains of the moon, if you will. And so we, ours was 8,000 feet, but there are a lot of other higher points on the moon.
Is there any scientific advances that have positively impacted the average person's life on Earth as a result of the rocks that we brought back from the moon?
Well, I think that there's a potential. The rocks on the moon have a concentration of helium-3. It's a helium isotope or helium molecule, and it's fissionable. And if you bring that back, a ton of it, I've been told, in a fission reactor, I think it is, it would generate enough nuclear power to power New York City for a whole year. So it's there's some really, really important minerals up there that we could learn to mine and then start transporting them back to Earth. So the future moon ride, like Artemis coming up, will be landing on the south pole of the region, which is a lot rougher than where we landed. That they picked that spot because if there's any water ice on the moon, it's down there, because the temperatures where we landed, it gets really hot during the day and everything is boiled off. So the landings that we've not landed at the South Pole, but we sent a spacecraft into the surface and it created a big explosion. And then we had another one behind it with spectrometers looking at what came out.
Huh.
And they saw a lot of hydrogen and oxygen. And so, wow, that might be ice.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So one ton of the rocks from the moon, if we get okay with nuclear power and a fission reactor, one ton would power New York City for a week, did you say? Or a month?
No, I've been told a year.
Oh, a year.
But a ton of helium, it's not the rocks of the moon, it's the helium that is extracted from the rocks.
Oh, okay.
So we don't have helium-3 here on Earth. Down here, helium just floats off and escapes the atmosphere because it's a low specific gravity. But up on the moon, you can manufacture a plant that will extract helium, this helium from the rocks, and then put it in a big container, put that on the spacecraft, and bring it back.
Fascinating.
And that's a long way off. But anyway, that's one of the future, I think, the reasons we might want to go to the moon, to set up a base on the moon again. A permanent base is to do some mining up there and extract these minerals. And there's a lot of other stuff up on the moon that's mineral-wise, it's valuable. So,
have you ever heard of the comedian Brian Regan and his bit on astronauts? You ever heard that?
Yeah, that's funny.
So, if you haven't heard this, I'm not sure if we can get the rights to replay it, or if I should just tell it.
You should tell us, because I don't know if Brian will give us the rights.
I'm going to tell you, and then I'd like you to tell me if there's what truth of it for you is when you're at a party. So the bit is basically like Brian Regan talks about, we have this me monster inside of us. We're all about me, 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 me. And we always want to rank ourselves against other people, saying there's you, me, no matter what you do, I do this. And he says, oh, I'm at my cocktail party. And I just happen to gradually mention all the great things about life. Oh yeah, I'm an investment banker. I have a second car. I'm in Zurich, and I just kind of have my own private airplane. Like I'm in me, 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 me. He got this whole thing. And then Brian Regan says, you know, I wish I was an astronaut. Because then I could just sit there and let people go and say, whoa, go ahead. Well, what are you talking about? And then I would just say very nonchalantly as I'm eating my broccoli, I went to the moon. Yeah, I got to tell you, as you were talking about your second car, Luke Skywalker, I remember when I was up in the room, up in the moon, in my lunar rover. I was going about 600 miles an hour. I thought, oh no, I better slow down. I realized, oh, wait, I don't have to slow down. I'm the only one up here. And then no one could top that. So I just wonder, do you ever find yourself identifying with that or having actually used that line in the real world?
I don't volunteer the information that I landed on the moon. And a lot of times at a cocktail party, people say, well, Charlie, what do you do? And I said, well, I've had a career in the military. Now I'm a businessman, but I've had a career in the military as test pilot, pilot, astronaut. And said, oh, what did you do? I don't even volunteer. I walked on the moon. I said, well, what did you do as an astronaut? I said, well, I was the Apollo 16. I was the 10th man to walk on the moon. And they said, oh, really? Yeah. I don't really volunteer that information. It's to brag about it. More and more now, as I travel and speak, I get people recognizing me. And I was on American Airlines, and we landed, and I went up to the, as I was leaving the aircraft, I went up past the cockpit, of course, and I leaned in and said, hey, I'm Charlie Duke. I want to thank you for this really great ride. And the guy turned around and says, you're Charlie Duke. Man, I didn't. And he starts, gets on the PA system and starts bragging about a moonwalker on the airplane with us all. And
wow.
he's still a good friend of mine. And
that's great.
It started a friendship.
Well, one of the books I read, just as I've been geeking out on this again, I can't say it enough. I've just been geeking out on this stuff. So it's so good talking. I don't know if anybody else is enjoying this conversation. I don't really care about that. I'm enjoying the conversation. So thanks so much for this. But when I went through, oh gosh, what was the name of the book? It was the Right Stuff. You know,
yeah.
It really dawned on me. I didn't realize until then that, oh, we give these guys kudos for walking on the moon, but they only got to walk on the moon because they were badass pilots who had the quote unquote right stuff, who were willing to risk life and limb to ride the ends of the envelope. And yeah, a big, big deal. So yeah, if you're a pilot, anybody walking the moon will be a hero because you were the top 1% of the 1% of anybody who was ever in a cockpit on the entire world at the time.
Yeah, that's true. We were very fortunate. Most of us back in those days were. Hold on a minute. I'm sorry. Stop the recording.
It's the moon calling. It's the moon calling. You forgot a shoe up here in the moon. You better come pick a shoe back up.
He's trying to find his phone.
That's all right. Is that Mrs. Duke I'm overhearing?
Yes, you are.
What is your name, ma'am?
My name's Dorothy.
Hi, were you guys married when Charlie went to the moon?
I think so. We've been married 61 years.
61 years. Wow.
Yeah,
come on over. Let me see here. Talking to an astronaut's wife is just as fulfilling as talking to an astronaut. What I'm curious, when he went to the moon, that had to be terrifying for you. Was it or was it not terrifying?
Well, by the time he went, and even I think at the very beginning, we really weren't terrified, the wives. I wasn't anyway. NASA had been very successful in all their earlier missions with Mercury and Gemini. And so I had a lot of trust and faith in Charlie and in the NASA. And so it was exciting. I mean, this is why we were at NASA, for him to go. And you didn't want him sitting on the bench. You wanted him to go. We were very excited about it. And I was too.
You guys ever see the movie First Man with Ryan Gosling and the trip flight to the moon? I thought what was really cool about that movie was they showed really well the toil and stress on those first astronauts' wives. And
well,
I like
unfortunately, that movie was not true. it was true. I don't know why the kids approved it. And I've talked to them about it. but the way they portrayed Neil and his marriage was not true.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I've told people not to watch it or just to forget what they saw.
Fascinating.
They weren't, the trouble in their marriage started a lot later than that time when he got back from the moon. The way they ended was at the end of the movie, there's Neil behind the glass and she walks in and they don't say anything.
Yeah.
I mean, they were jumping up and down with excitement. Yeah. And this is the way it really was. Yeah. So.
And they didn't betray Neil well either. You know, all the people that they portrayed in the movie with him are dead, were dead. Hmm. Even Jan, before she died, before the movie came out, she had seen it and told them that it wasn't true.
Oh, that's a great word. Oh, thank you.
Apollo, that movie Tom Hanks did, Apollo 13, was really good.
Yeah, that one. Yeah.
So you approve with that one, Apollo 13?
Yeah, really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're just two things they brought in that weren't true.
go ahead. Yeah. Tell us, what were those two things?
Okay, they were personal things, which I thought were very unnecessary to even have in the movie. First was that they showed Ken drinking beer and locked in his apartment when the accident happened, and that it was very hard for them to get hold of him. Well, no, as soon as he heard about it, he was watching the whole thing. As soon as he heard about it, he ran, or he got to NASA really quick, to Mission Control, to help. So that was not true about Ken. And then the part two about kind of implying that maybe Jack Schweigert wasn't good enough and that maybe he had made a mistake and things like that. Not true at all. Charlie will tell you that he was supposed to be the best guy at that sort of thing that was going on. And so that was wrong. And he was dead at that time. And we were with his sister after the movie, and it hurt her feelings very much that they betrayed her brother like that. Mm. So I don't know why people try to get into personal stuff. It isn't true.
Yeah. Well, they got to find their level of drama to try to sell tickets.
Yeah, it wouldn't take anything away from the movie to have let that part out. But the rest of it was...
It was really a good movie, though, if you just overlooked that look. And you wouldn't realize that unless you were intimate to the knowledge of knowing everybody in the personally in the movie. And they just sort of took a little few liberties. But I told Tom Hanks after we saw it, there was a group of us, the NASA people, who did it. We're in Mission Control, and so we had a special screening, and after it was all over, I told Tom, I said, this was a great movie. I knew how it was going to end up, and I was sitting on the edge of my seat. So you really captured the intensity of the Mission Control and the crew. So he did a good job.
Yeah.
So that was Apollo 13 with Tom Hanks. And you, when you walked the moon, you were Apollo what?
16. And I was backup on Apollo 13. And my name's mentioned in the movie. 3 or 4 days before the flight liftoff, I catch the measles. And I exposed everybody to the measles. And Mattingly was the only crew member that hadn't had the measles. So there was a substitution. Mattingly got pulled off because he could get the measles at the moon, and the guy took his place was Jack Swigert, backup, who I trained with. And anyway, after 3 or 4 days of training, Jim Lovell, the commander, said, "We're ready to go." So they lifted right off on schedule. So this shows the quality of training that we had back in those days, where three guys trained and three other guys train, and we go together, and you could take one of those guys on the backup crew and substitute him into the prime crew, and they have a cohesive crew after this 3 days. So it was a very good testament of the quality of the training that we all had.
Right.
It was a good movie.
Thank you, sweetie. Thank you very much. Great insight. Thanks for coming in, blessing us with your knowledge.
Oh, thank you.
All right. I hope you're not going to call punch me for calling your wife sweetie, Charlie. I hope you're not going to do that. Taking care of your health isn't always easy, but it should be at least simple. That's why for the last 2 years, I've been drinking AG1 every day, no exceptions, at home, on a hunting trip, camping off my motorcycle, no exceptions. It's just one scoop mixed in water once a day. every day, and it makes me feel ready to get moving. That's because each serving of AG1 delivers my daily dose of vitamins, minerals, pre and probiotics, and more. It's a powerful, healthy habit that's also powerfully simple. I like to have it in the morning. I have a 12 ounce of water, so right off the bat, I'm helping my hydration every single morning. This is the one product, if I had to recommend one, I'd recommend this one to elevate your health. It's AG1, and that's why I partnered with them for 2 years. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and five free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/aggressivelife. That's drinkag1.com/aggressivelife. Get yourself some. You're the voice from Mission Control on Apollo 11. And then, you know, several missions later, you're walking on the moon. How does that work? They always want an actual astronaut being the voice? Were you hoping to get promoted? Was that a promotion? What is your attitude of being, you know, if we bring our faith into this, at that point, were you having the demeanor of Christ, where you are having a servanthood attitude, doing the somewhat unglorious task and happy with that? Or are you itching for more? I think you understand what I'm asking. What, just talk about all that.
The sequence in Apollo was we had three crews. We had a support crew. These guys weren't going to go. They didn't have no chance to go, but they supported the backup crew, who was the substitute crew if the prime crew got sick or had an accident, got killed, and then the prime crew. And so on Apollo 10, I was the support crew and did a lot of work on the lunar module. So I was CAPCOM, and in Mission Control, the CAPCOM was always an astronaut. And you got assigned to that job. And so there were four shifts. And our shift happened to be on for the activation and checkout of the lunar module on Apollo 10. Well, that was the same dress rehearsal, basically, that Neil Armstrong would go do 2 months later. So I wasn't on the support. I wasn't supposed to be there, but Neil came to me, and the flight director says, Charlie, you did the same thing. You did Apollo 10. And we're going to do the same thing on Apollo 11. We want you to be CAPCOM for the landing. And the only difference, we'll tag on the landing instead of just descent and board back up. So I was the obvious choice for CAPCOM. At that point, I didn't have a crew assignment. But right after that, I got put on the backup crew for Apollo 13. And then the rotation was backup crew, three flights later you'd fly. So from 13, I got to 16 and flew to the moon on 16 with John Young. My experience on Apollo 10 gave Neil the confidence and the flight director that I would be the obvious choice for CAPCOM. And he asked me, and they assigned me that job. And so for 2 months, we trained with the crew, and Mission Control actually on every flight saved the day, if you will, overcoming those problems we had on descent, communication problems, computer problems, trajectory problems that led to final a fuel problem. And so it was very critical. Mission Control did the right thing, made the right decisions. And we continued to landing with 17 seconds fuel remaining before we were going to call them abort. So it was very close, but I'm convinced that we got to abort. What we said was Eagle abort. It would have been a silence back there and said, well, say again, Houston. And he's 30 feet off the moon or thereabouts. And we say, abort, he's going to land.
Right.
So But the mission
because of,
rule.
Because of that right stuff, aggressive, flying the edge of the envelope, always push it mentality, you have to have to get into that program. These are not conservative people. And in a moment, I want to. But in just a moment before you finish this, this is where I want to take the rest of our time together. It's not so much about space. It's the attitude behind it. So keep going, Charlie.
Well, so the attitude, I mean, he gets the big picture. He can see out the window. He knows he's 30 feet off the moon. All we know, he's 30 feet off the moon. And we're running out of gas. Well, abort meant he had 4% fuel remaining to throttle up the engine to full power and start a climb out away from the moon and then abort stage, drop off the descent stage. So that 4% he could use to land, and he had to, and at 20, 30 feet off the moon, he had plenty of gas to continue that descent. So he had the final say. Now, if he'd have been 3,000 feet above the moon, he'd have probably aborted and we'd have lost the landing. But we weren't that far behind. Mission control was on top of everything. And so we gave him the call. But fortunately, I didn't have to say abort in mission control. We heard Burzall say, contact, engine stop. And buddy, you know they were on the ground.
Right.
And shortly thereafter, Neil very coolly said, Houston, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed. And then I responded with so excited, I couldn't even pronounce Tranquility. It came out twang. I said, Roger, twang, Tranquility, we copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. And it was true. So it's a very exciting, tense moments at the end. But I want to give another shout out for Mission Control. They saved the day on just about every Apollo mission. There was something went wrong, and those guys were so sharp and so ability to work around these problems that we didn't have a failure. The only real problem we had was on Apollo 13, where it wasn't oxygen tank blew up, and but we got them back, and that was the success of Apollo 13. That these guys weren't. Didn't die in space.
Yeah.
And could have if we had done the right things.
Yeah, it's really good to be reminded that there's some people who get the limelight in life, but the vast masses of us just have to hit our marks, hit the same nail, do the same thing over and over, mission control. And most of us are not going to be on a stage, even asked to be on a podcast, going to have whatever, whatever. But it's that kind of day in, day out faithfulness that is important for the mission and might just stage us for something different on down the line.
Yeah, no question.
We might have lost a lot of listeners by now, because I'm really geeking out on the ins and outs of the space mission, where myself 3 years ago, I would have shut off the podcast, because I didn't find space and math and all that stuff that intriguing 3 years ago. But what I came to really understand recently was, hey, this isn't a, yes, it is science. Yes, it is math. Yes, it is space. Yes, it is propulsion. It is research. Yeah, all that stuff. But that stuff didn't get me. But what really got me was I'd never really understood the aggressive nature of the space race. I didn't understand how Americans initially were so freaked out that the Soviets were getting a leg up on us. And we were freaked out because, oh man, maybe they're going to start firing nukes at us. I remember in first grade, I think I was the last class in America in 1971, in first grade, I remember getting underneath our desks for fear of nuclear attack and stuff. And there was this collective thought in America that the Russians are ahead of us. Communism is evil. They're going to get nukes and they're going to crush us. And in America, morale was low. Fear was very high. And NASA comes along and says, hey, we're going to change everything we're doing for a 10x return. We're going to change our systems. There's a memo that I have and I read pretty frequently. We're going to change our systems. We're going to change everything to beat the Soviets and do a basic moonshot, be the first ones to march on the moon. And Kennedy has that crazy, crazy speech where he says, why would we do this? He said, because it's hard. That's why we're doing it, because it's hard. He says, why does Rice play Texas? Because it's hard. And I heard that. I get goosebumps right now. I don't see us as a country doing things that are hard anymore. I see us I see us getting mad at each other anymore. I don't see us as human beings doing things that are hard anymore. Like, if something is hard, we're upset. Someone must not have done adequate planning. Someone must think this is an irresponsible thing. No, sometimes we do it because it's hard. And when I look at the things that you guys did, the sacrifices you made, the potential cost to life, especially like with Apollo 8, no life raft. Like Apollo 8, those problems happen on Apollo 11. There's no movie. No, you're dead. You're dead. Now I'm starting to preach to Charlie Duke. I'm just kind of venting and letting people in America in on this who are listening. These guys take off with the 10X mission to be the first ones to orbit the moon. No one's done it before. There's no life raft. And they take off on Christmas Eve, if I'm not mistaken, take off, because that's the right time to meet up with the moon that's going 2,280 miles an hour. The moon's going, and we got to mesh up with it, and we got to get it so where the right side is to us, and we got to beat the Soviets. And now America's got to say, all the decision makers, wait a minute, we're going to launch this thing on Christmas Eve, and if this thing doesn't work out, which is very likely, Christmas is ruined for the rest of American history, because we look up in the moon and you can't get out of the gravitational pull, and there's dead Americans, three dead Americans that are orbiting the moon forever. And there's no rescue mission. There's no nothing. There's no life raft. And they went for it. Wow. I'm going like, we're not doing that kind of stuff anymore.
No, it was a very risky mission. The decision was, we'd heard that the Russians were going to launch a mission to the moon, and they were going to win the space race by having the first human beings there. So the second flight of Apollo was Apollo 8. They were designed just to go check out the spacecraft in Earth orbit. And NASA management and the crew said, well, we're ready to go. We'll take that risk. And so they launched the second time they'd flown the command module. And they'd launched first time on the big Saturn rocket with people. And the crew said, we're ready to take that test and challenge the Russians. And so they said, we're ready to go. And so, but it was a big risk. And but the Saturn proved out, the spacecraft held together. Actually, they launched a few days before Christmas Eve. On Christmas Eve, they were in orbit, and that's when they had the TV came on, and they had the TV with the Earth coming up behind the moon.
Got it.
I think that was, except for Neil Armstrong's, that's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. The most exciting words to me was when they started reading from Genesis.
Right.
In the beginning, God created Earth. There's just the Earth out there. And very moving to me and most Americans. It was really something. But it was a risky flight. It had to work or they're dead.
Yeah.
And they're ready to take the chance.
Yeah. I think there's adequate debate for Americans to say, has the scientific return on investment been worth it? I think that's fine. We can have the debate. I think it's worth it to say, you know, it was 4% of our national budget going to NASA in that early day. Was that worth it? I think that's fine to have that the debate. But I think what I want to focus on and celebrate more and just say we don't have enough of is we don't have enough genuine risk-taking. We don't have enough genuine aggressive moves. And if it wasn't worth the ROI, there's no way to have known, even if it wasn't, which I'm not saying it wasn't, there's no way to have known unless we actually go for it. And that's kind of what this podcast is about. Most of us are not going to be making none of us are going to make $1 trillion decisions. Most of us are not going to make $1 billion decisions or even $1 million decisions. But there are decisions you can make with how you live your life, which can be just do the same old, or what's a moonshot that I may need to take in my life, a vision I may need to go after. And that's why I'm so inspired by your line of work, Charlie, and what you and all your comrades have done. It's a great service you've done to all of us.
Well, thank you very much. I just think it's what I see is it's so exciting to me now is the civilians that started these, I call them private enterprise space companies. And with, you know, they SpaceX is one, Blue Origin is one. These guys did it all on their own. And they came to NASA and says, hey, NASA, this is what we got. You want to buy it? And NASA said, yeah, we'll buy that. And look at the success of SpaceX.
Right.
One of the best decisions I think NASA ever made was investing in these private companies in space. And so it was an opportunity. And people can look at Elon and Jeff Bezos and others that are involved in that and said, hey, I can do something like that. And so they get inspired. They took risk. I think that's the beauty of America is people willing to take risk. And NASA's getting back to that, I think, with Artemis. But I see more and more and more SpaceX taking over and Blue Origin taking over near space and NASA going on. Let's concentrate on deep space to the moon and beyond.
But we've also lost a lot. It seems like we've lost a lot of knowledge with, you know, all of your community who's passed on, retired or whatever. I don't even know if we could even land on the moon anymore. Didn't someone land the moon recently and the thing tipped over? We've lost a lot of knowledge.
I'm involved with a company that Lone Star Data Holdings, and that we had a payload on that. It tipped over, but it was okay. We still got some data back from it. But, you know, the private industry is making the lunar landers, and they are huge. And I think that we'll be successful. They've got so much technology now that they can pinpoint the exact landing spot and know the slopes and present it all to the crew, and they can come in. And so I see success. It's Artemis is the name of the mission. It's a very complicated mission, especially the follow-on, not the first one, but the follow-on landings. But it'll be something that with the NASA's contracts and the private companies that are working in, it'll bring glory back to the U.S.
That's cool. All right. I have one more open-ended question for you, Charlie. And then I want to bring you into our lightning round. I want to do a few really quick shot answers if you're up for that. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Great. So here's my open-ended question. Given that my thesis and my foundation for why I'm so fascinated in space exploration and the great things we've done in the past, since it is rooted in an admiration for the aggressive moves that this was on behalf of you and everyone who you were basically in relationship with all those many decades ago, I'm curious, as you were on the edge of the envelope in your professional life, your flying life, your aeronautical life, when you were done walking on the moon and done with that sort of thing, was there any translations that you made from that experience to your personal life? Did it equip you to make more aggressive moves in your marriage, in your career? Were there ways that it changed you and how you looked at the world and how you made decisions?
Well, first off, after Apollo was over, I was 37 years old, and I'd climbed the ladder of success, and I was at the very top of my career. And the thought occurred to me and a lot of other guys, what are you going to do now with the rest of your life? After 4 years of working on a space shuttle, after Apollo was over, I left NASA and went into private business. I thought, now making money would be a challenge. And so it was private business, and I was successful. And then at that point, though, we were in, as I said earlier, we were in bad shape with our marriage, and Dottie became a Christian, and I watched her change totally. So as after I sold the business, made a lot of money, now what am I going to do? Well, I went to Bible study, and that's where my life started to change. And now I've, over the last 15, 20 years, not only been doing Christian work, but I'm a very, I guess, popular motivational speaker. And I find it very, very rewarding to talk about my career and challenge others as the companies that invited me or associations to tell them about how we did it in Apollo. And tell kids especially, keep your antennas up and you don't know where it's going to take you. Study hard, think beyond Z, and you'll have a very exciting career. You might not make it to the moon, but you can have a very exciting career.
What does think beyond Z mean? I like that. What's that mean?
That came from a Dr. Seuss book that I was reading to my kids. And it's a kid named Conrad Cornelius O'Donnell O'Dell, a very young man who was learning to spell. The Z, the A is for eight, the B is for bear, the C is for cat, through to Z. Z is for zebra. I know them all well, says Conrad Cornelius O'Donnell O'Dell. Then he almost fell flat on his face on the floor when I picked up the chalk and drew one letter more. Because the things that I see and the things that I do, I could never spell if I stopped with the Z. So I use that a lot.
Oh, that's great.
To the kids.
Oh, that's cool. Man, such a rich time. So that's so good, Charlie. Thank you. All right. So here's what I want to do. I want to ask you a couple some questions called the lightning round, because I'd like you to answer them like a flash of lightning, like real quick hitter things. Boom, 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 boom. Are you ready for the lightning round, Charlie Duke? Man who has walked the moon, man who is a part of world history, man who has aggressively gone into business. Are you ready for it?
Yes.
Okay, here we go. What's going through your mind right before takeoff?
Keep counting. I don't want an abort.
I like that. Scariest part of space travel?
Probably the riskiest. Let me say riskiest was landing on the moon. Second would probably re-entry. It had to work.
Most aggressive mistake you made in your career and what you learned from it?
In my career, the biggest mistake I made was on the moon when I tried to set the high jump record. And when I jumped, I fell over backwards onto my life support system. Fear took over. But fear is not bad if you don't panic. I had this thought, roll right. And I rolled right and I broke my fall and my heart was pounding like this. And so the lesson learned was never do anything in space you hadn't practiced on Earth. And I'd never practiced that high jump.
Oh, that's interesting. What movie comes the closest to depicting the reality of space travel?
I would say Apollo 13.
What gets you excited about your life back on the ground when you're up in space?
Well, family, I believe, a marriage and family. I was looking forward to seeing the boys again. They were 5 and 7 at the time. And I love being a dad and love being married. And even though we did have a lot of problems, we overcame those. And thinking about family was very special.
So you've had a long career in an unbelievably dangerous operation. You had to be attracted to that because part of you likes adrenaline, shots of adrenaline. And it's basically who becomes, you know, jet engine pilots and all that kind of stuff. So right now, what are you doing right now that might be a little aggressive or adrenaline or just maybe something that someone else your age might not normally want to do?
Well, I'm working with a couple of companies. One is Aptricity. We track people's equipment, and that's going very well. I'm invested in a company called Phantom Space, some of the SpaceX guys, and they're building a new little rocket that's going to be, I think, good. So, and then several other events I've invested in lately where I get to advise. Next week, I'm headed to Houston to as a consultant on with Intuitive Machines, and they're building the lunar rover And Jack Schmidt and I are the only two guys that left alive that rode the rover on the moon. Well, wow. Dave Scott, but he's retired, so he's not going. But Jack and I are going to be there and give our 2 cents worth. So I'm consulting in some ways on some things. So I'm staying busy. And my Christian ministry is a big part of our life. And also we accept talks at various churches and Christian groups all over the world.
Well, in that meeting, you've got to start working your repertoire. When I was cruising on the Sea of Tranquility in my lunar rover, you just got to start dropping that in. Oh, that's so good. Hey, one other thing I just learned a couple days ago I didn't know about was that the original astronauts, and I assume it was the same with you, wanted to have some sort of life insurance, and their wives couldn't find life insurance. How does a company, be able to figure out what the payment or the premium should be? That they signed a bunch of envelopes before they went off that the wives could sell off to give them some money. I thought that was fascinating.
That was our insurance policy. Every flight did that at Apollo, especially. We called them insurance covers. And they were just little envelopes that were postmarked the day of liftoff and were going to be postmarked. And we signed them all three, and every flight did it. In our flight, we did 500 of them, split them up between all of the wives and the family. So if we didn't get back, they had these things to sell. So that's why they were called insurance covers. And you're right. We couldn't get any insurance. I had military insurance, but it was, $25,000 or something like that. But it was exorbitant fees or premiums, I should say.
Right. Are those letters still possessed by somebody someplace?
We split them up when we got back. I got a third, John got a third, and Ken got a third. And there's some, not only from our flight and others, on the market. They've been sold, and so they are available. Wow. Auction market. I've sold a few, but privately, and so we do have some. And I don't know how many I got left, but it's.
I mean, do you ever run across a pastor, a podcast host who's actually the most informed interviewer you've ever encountered and is actually being used by God in a mighty way and actually tithes and just like give him one of those? Has that ever happened to you?
I don't understand your question, but yeah.
I'm saying, come on, I'm qualified. I've given you better questions than any other losers have. Come on, I'm a little informed.
You've been really good,
Ron. I gotta make an aggressive ask. Like, why not? If you've got a number of them.
I got to say, you got more enthusiasm than most guys than most guys that interview me, I should say.
Yeah.
You motivate me.
All right. Thanks, brother. Hey, is there anything that we should have talked about that we haven't talked about? Anything you wish I would have asked you that I didn't ask you? This is your time.
Not really. I get a lot of questions about what do you think about going back to the moon? And Artemis is a very major undertaking. And so whatever I can do to help them be successful, I want to try to do. If I'm, if I'm still capable, I'll be 89 years old in October 3rd. And so, but I'm still in good health and I still travel. And hopefully we'll be able to help out on the future land missions to the moon.
Gosh, 89. That reminds me of something else I'd love to ask you if I can have a couple more minutes from you is, when I look at your life, Buzz Aldrin, Lance Armstrong, Frank Borman, the other names escape me right now from Apollo 8. As I do some of that reading, you guys are all guys who are crazy ass active in your 80s and 90s I mean, Frank goes and he buys a World War II Mustang. And gosh, I can't remember his name. What's it? The other guy, the guy who took all the photographs on Apollo 8, his good buddy.
Bill Landers.
Yeah, I think it was. And who was the other one? Bill Landers and.
Frank Borman was a commander of Bill Landers, and then Jim Lovell were the three on Apollo 8.
Okay, it was Jim Lovell. And Frank Borman said to Jim Lovell, he said, look, I'll buy it if you fly it. Because he already had one. And so he's, so I'm reading them going, my gosh, you're getting into a World War II plane. And I think they were 85 when they bought and flew that thing back from the flight. So you're, I'm looking at the things that you're doing. Buzz Aldrich is punching somebody in the face when he's, you know, 80. It seems like the people who were astronauts have a level of, activity in their life that the average senior citizens don't. Do you think that's because you've maintained a razor edge of your mind and you've kept pushing yourself physically? Or is it you're very unique physical specimens that were attracted to the NASA program and made the cut in your 20s, which meant you'd be the kind of people who could be doing what you're doing in your 90s? What's your thoughts?
I think it's a little bit of both, as far as, the motivation to stay in shape. I've always had when I got selected for the space program, I said, I got to stay in shape. And so I started working out at 30 years old. I'm still working out. I take care of myself. I'm not extravagant in enjoying a beer, and, I do, but, I don't drink a lot. And, anyway, it's just a lot of, desire to stay in shape. Yeah, I tease about this. You never know. NASA might call and need a replacement, but I don't think that. Said, don't call us. We'll call you. But, you know, at 90 years old, our next door neighbor was Bill Landers on Apollo 8. Well, he was just killed in a private airplane at T-34, which he had he owned a museum of World War II airplanes and all, and he was flying at 90 years old. He's still doing acrobatics, and for some reason he was over the water and misjudged or something. I don't know what happened there, and he hit the water and was killed just a couple months ago. So those dangers are still there, and still people are still doing them. I don't fly anymore because my wife won't get in a little airplane with me. She said it bounces too much. And what if you have a heart attack? And so,
I didn't know that about Bill Landers. What a dream death that is for an astronaut. You're 90 and you die in a cockpit, and I got to think instantaneously and painlessly, and you just had a thrill doing loop-de-loop. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
You know,
on the other side, it's sad, but they died doing what he was doing. He loved it, and he was a good pilot. He used to fly the Reno Air Races at younger days in his 70s. These high performance, you know, 40 feet off the ground and is around those pylons. And he was a good aviator, and it was just nobody know. They don't know what happened yet, but it was tragic.
I love that line, NASA might call.
Yeah. Never know. I'm getting called for advice now, but not for the astronaut program anymore.
Yeah, but I think it's really good for us to live with an awareness of, I may need to do something difficult at a moment's notice. And am I ready? Yeah. And I mean, something difficult spiritually? Is my walk deep enough with God that if I got to rise up, I can do it? And physically, am I physically capable? If something pops up, I can step up. I think it's really great to live in a state of preparedness. I love that.
I agree. That's why I stay in shape. We got a little gym in the basement of our house. And so it's very convenient to put on your workout clothes at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or 5 o'clock and go down and spend an hour, an hour and a half, walking a treadmill or pedaling a bike, lifting weights and, exercises. And that keeps me fit and, at the right weight. And so, you know, God knows when you're going to drop dead. So, I mean, I could be the best shape ever, and it's time for me to go. And so, yeah, with a stroke or a heart attack or something like that. So just, I'm ready. I'd like to live to 100, but who knows?
Yeah. And, Charlie, you've been so generous with your time and with your wisdom. This is wonderful. Give yourself an advertisement for yourself. Like if someone wants to follow up with your work, if they want to know what you're doing, if they want to, if you want them to see anything or go anywhere, where would that be?
I got a website, charlieduke.com, and you can go to the website, and there's an email there you can call or write to. It, sometimes it takes me a while to get prompt on the answers because I'm so busy. And we just moved to South Carolina about a year and a half ago, and we're still in the process of trying to get an office established and hire somebody to help me out. So, anyway, I try to answer a lot. So,
Charlie,
be available. Thanks a lot.
Man, you've dropped a rich amount on us. And I'll just close this out by saying to everybody, hey, there's something here that General Charlie Duke shared that is going to, should impact your life. It will mine. It is mine. Always being prepared. Is that what it is? Willing to take a subservient role, and then you get to walk on the moon, always trying to do something different, starting business. How about just like listening to your wife and growing in your spiritual journey and being humble enough to receive Christ? I mean, there's so many things. This is called the aggressive life, not the interesting thoughts life. I hope you've had something here that's going to make you do something different. And Charlie, as soon as I sign off, I will send you my address to get one of those envelopes. All right, we'll see you next time on The Aggressive Life.
Adios. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on this journey toward aggressive living. Find more resources, articles, past episodes, and live events over at briantome.com. My new books, a repackaged edition of The 5 Marks of a Man, and a brand new 5 Marks of a Man tactical guide are open right now on Amazon. If you haven't yet, leave this podcast a rating and review. It really helps get the show in front of new listeners. And if you want to connect, find me on Instagram at Brian Tome. The Aggressive Life is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio.